Today is Thursday, February 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. U.S. President Joe Biden speaks to the events taking place in Myanmar, also known as Burma.
The military must relinquish power it seized and demonstrate respect for the will of the people of Burma.
Plus, day two of former President Donald Trump's impeachment trial.
On January 6th itself, the greatest betrayal of the presidential oath in the history of the United States.
And a little hip-hop history. We'll have these stories and more next. U.S. President Joe Biden spoke to reporters Wednesday afternoon, calling on the Burmese military to reverse its coup and subsequent crackdown.
I again call on the Burmese military to immediately release the democratic political leaders and activists, and they're now detained, including Aung San Suu Kyi, and she is, and also Win Myint, the president. The military must relinquish power it seized and demonstrate respect for the will of the people of Burma, as expressed in their November 8th election.
He then went on to detail the first set of actions the United States was taking towards those now in power, including steps to prevent the generals from improperly having access to the $1 billion in Burmese government funds held in the United States.
A new executive order enabling us to immediately sanction the military leaders who directed the coup, their business interests, as well as close family members. We will identify at first round of targets this week, and we're also going to impose strong exports controls. We're freezing U.S. assets that benefit the Burmese government while maintaining our support for health care, civil society groups, and other areas that benefit the people of Burma directly. And finally, as protests grow, violence against those asserting their democratic rights is unacceptable, and we're going to keep calling it out. The people of Burma are making their voices heard, and the world is watching. We'll be ready to impose additional measures, and we'll continue to work with our international partners to urge other nations to join us in these efforts.
The United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights in Myanmar has expressed alarm at the use of lethal force by security forces against protesters. Tom Andrews said, quote, military personnel and police need to know that following orders is no defense for committing atrocities, and any such defense will fail, regardless of their place in the chain of command. International crimes, he continued, are manifestly unlawful. In Myanmar, protesters took to the streets for a fifth day on Wednesday, vowing to keep up demonstrations against the coup, even after a woman was shot and critically wounded during clashes the previous day. And to get a broader picture of where things stand, I spoke with VOA Burmese Service Chief Tan Luen Tun from his home via Microsoft Teams.
This is kind of a new way of protest or demonstrations organized by the group, but they refer themselves as a Generation Z. So this is the new young generation, you know, which actually is not that much of the connection with the political party, like especially even with the National League for Democracy, although they say that they voted for it. But the way they came out is not about that, what I call, political parties or people or leader, but just to express their concern about their life and a military regime or military rule, and also about they see this situation is just simply undermining their rights, democratic rights. Because they have voted very recently, and the military took over and put them under the military control. Is for them, it is not acceptable. People these days came out today on the street, but the way they do is that they try to avoid kind of a confrontation.
Now, Luen, I also understand you have some new information about a possible draft law concerning communications in the country.
Yes, the so-called Generation Z. It's a very, very savvy group of young people. They organize, they communicate each other by effectively using communication tools. So they just strategize all those their movement, and then also especially for the what they call it civil disobedience movement. So obviously the military is very, very worried about that situation. So they have been trying to control that kind of a traffic in a kind of social media and internet. As you see that one day, the day they staged the coup, they cut off telephone communications and internet. And then later on, they just simply request all those telecom company and a service provider in the country to drop the service about social media, including Facebook and Instagram. But later on, they have to release that restrictions. So internet is come back. But now they try to control permanently in that sense that social media, which being used effectively by the Generation Z, that those young activists. And because the way they are now trying to do is, if they shut down or if they simply slow down internet, there will be a lot of other side effects, for example, like banking sector. So they try to now control the social media and internet traffic, cyber traffic, by using Chinese technology. And also they try to implement a very, very restricted cybersecurity law, which may be effectively, they will make it a law by 15th February.
Owen, one last question. The United States announced new sanctions and new actions on Wednesday, February 10th. President Biden also called for Aung San Suu Kyi and President Win Myint to be released. This echoes calls by other international leaders. How has the Burmese military responded to these calls?
There's no immediate reactions on that call. For example, like the Burmese military were trying to justify their action. What I heard from Burma is that Burmese military increase or just step up the more arrest of a lot of people, and they might have just came up with that officially charging those arrested leader on the charges like corruption, party fundraising issue, or receiving foreign donations, or so many other things they might come up with it. Even with sometime they might be coming up with a high treason, so who knows. So with that kind of charges, and then it is a domestic law, they are internal law, and how could international community can ask them to release them immediately in that sense?
Tan Luen Tan is the chief of the VOA Burmese service. House Democrats continued their prosecution on Wednesday of Donald Trump's impeachment trial, this time with video highlighting what they say was his incitement of the deadly siege of the Capitol last month. The lead manager of the House Democrats' effort, Jamie Raskin, said that Trump planted seeds for the riot by encouraging violence and making false claims the election was stolen long before January 6th.
Donald Trump surrendered his role as commander-in-chief and became the inciter-in-chief of a dangerous insurrection. And this was, as one of our colleagues put it so cogently on January 6th itself, the greatest betrayal of the presidential oath in the history of the United States.
Now, to get a full breakdown of the day's events, I spoke with VOA's Steve Reddish.
The House managers used a combination of video, some of it that had never been seen before, especially video from Capitol security cameras. So they used the video that we've seen as well as unseen up until today, and a combination of the president's own words from the rally that day, as well as the tweets that he used in the days before January 6th and in the hours after the rally and as the attack was unfolding. The House managers used a combination of that to really try to bring the senators back to that day and relive what happened. And as it turns out, it is 5 weeks to the day when the Capitol attack took place. So there was an opportunity there for the House managers to really try and bring the senators back and have them not only relive what they experienced, but see what everyone else experienced, especially from the perspective of the Capitol Police. These are people that the senators have to walk into the Capitol and look in the eye every day, and to see what they went through defending the Capitol, defending the senators, was what the Democrats wanted to make sure that the senators understood that this was not just some incident that happened somewhere else, but it happened not just to them, but to people who they depend on every day.
Now, Steve, you mentioned that part of the arguments by the House managers were to include previously unseen video taken within the Capitol by security cameras. Can you share with our international audience maybe one such thing that hadn't been viewed before?
One thing that struck me was this video from a hallway, and you could see a line of people streaming out of a door, walking down the stairs, and then you can see clearly Vice President Mike Pence as he's being hustled down the stairway, his family in front of him, and Secret Service and other officers and other people behind them. The speed at which these people were trying to get down the steps, and the look in Mike Pence's face, the vice president's face, as he looked back to the camera for just a moment, was something that was rather striking.
Steve Reddish is an executive producer in the VOA newsroom. And coming up later.
Well, hip hop is a culture based on a music element, an art element, a dance element, and a spoken word element.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Several thousand exoplanets, or planets that exist beyond our solar system, have been found and confirmed since first being discovered in 1992. Most of the planets found orbiting other stars were discovered with the use of the transit method. This system for detecting exoplanets involves astronomers looking for regular and significant dips in a star's brightness, indicating that a planet had passed by it. However, very few of these planets have been directly imaged or visually observed. That may change. Astronomers at the European Southern Observatory in Chile suggest in a new study that ground-based telescopes could capture direct images of distant planets three times the size of Earth and located within the habitable zone of their host stars if they are equipped with newly developed imaging technology along with extended observation times. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Ugandan authorities have restored internet access in the country on Wednesday, a month after blocking it ahead of the January 14th elections. The government said the disruption was needed for security, while critics say it was intended to cut off communication among opponents of President Yoweri Museveni. Halima Athumani has the details.
In a tweet Wednesday, Ugandan Minister for Information and Communications Technology, Peter Gwang, said internet and social media services have been fully restored. He added, "We apologize for the inconveniences caused, but it was for the security of our country." Government spokesman Ofwono Opondo says the shutdown was a method of war against elements that were a threat to the credibility of the elections. He says since those threats have been greatly neutralized, the government has restored access to social media websites, with the exception of Facebook.
We have released elements of social media, Twitter, Instagram, WhatsApp, because we think to a less extent, those are not as little as Facebook. So we shall examine going forward their posture on these other social media platforms that have been released, and that will inform how soon Facebook is restored.
Before the January 14th elections, President Museveni ordered the blocking of Facebook following reports that the company had shut down 220 accounts linked to the Ministry of Information and Communications Technology. Facebook said their accounts were fakes or duplicates being used to make posts by President Yoweri Museveni and his son, Lieutenant General Muhoozi Kainerugaba, appear more popular than they were. Some posts from their accounts also targeted the opposition National Unity Platform Party and its presidential candidate, Bobi Wine. National Unity Platform Party spokesperson Joel Senyonyi says Facebook was right to shut down the accounts.
Government continues to have a grip on social media because they want to control free speech, because they know that Ugandans have pretty much have social media as the avenue for their free expression. And that's why Facebook did carry out these investigations, because there was a lot of propaganda churned out by those government-run social media accounts.
Michael Nitegeka, an information technology expert, says the shutdown of Facebook is hurting many Ugandans' livelihoods because they rely on the social media site for marketing.
Because they don't have the resources to go to radio, they don't have the resources to go on TV, so their businesses largely depend on the Facebook market.
Dorothy Mukasa, Chief Executive Officer of Unwanted Witness, a digital rights organization, is calling for lawmakers to establish rules on internet access.
So what we should be doing as Ugandans is to continue to put government to account. You know, why did they shut down the internet? And also ask institutions like parliament or judiciary to put in place guidelines, because this is bound to happen over and over. Can we have guidelines in place, or even a law that will stipulate when should the internet be disrupted?
In the meantime, Ugandans continue to use virtual private networks to access Facebook without paying a social media tax introduced by the government in July 2018. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
Secretary of State Anthony Blinken recently told Congress he intends to revoke the designation of Houthis as a terrorist organization. Meanwhile, a State Department spokesman said that the United States will keep up pressure on the leadership of Yemen's Houthis. President Joe Biden told diplomats at the State Department that the war in Yemen must end, and to underscore U.S. commitment, Washington is ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales. David DeRoche, associate professor at the Near East Asia Center for Strategic Studies, explained to VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shanawi what prompted the new administration to put Yemen on the top of its foreign policy priorities.
The Houthis basically hold a significant portion of the Yemeni population hostage, and humanitarian aid for the ongoing famine there is dependent on the acquiescence of the Houthis to this. So I think the Trump administration, in its dying days, made a calculation that declaring the entire organization with the issuance of 5 licenses that would allow sanctions to be bypassed for humanitarian shipment would punish the Houthi organization while not impeding the humanitarian relief effort. I think that Blinken has looked at that and said, no, actually, we're not as good at discriminating sanctions as we think, and that the humanitarian damage caused by sanctioning what are undeniably bad actors is too much. So I think what you'll see are specific people within the Houthi organization sanctioned, and probably an expansion of sanctions on specific Houthi functionaries. But the blanket sanction is just seen as too broad to be functional, and that'll be lifted.
President Biden told diplomats at the State Department that the war in Yemen must end, and to underscore U.S. commitment, Washington is ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales. What prompted the new administration to put Yemen on its foreign policy priorities?
I think what really prompted it was campaign rhetoric. During the Trump years, the war in Yemen, which people forget, started in the Obama administration with the support of the Obama administration, to include Vice President Joe Biden. During the Trump administration, that came to be seen as closely identified as a Trump initiative. And there were people, particularly on the left wing of the party, who called for this. And so Biden said he'd do it. Now that he's there, he's doing it. But the practical impact of this, I think, is pretty small. Most of the American support for offensive operations have already been ceased. Air-to-air refueling, expedited logistics, that's all done. So we weren't doing that anyhow. So I think this is more a tone shift, telling the base of the party that I do what I said I I'm going to do. And then there's a certain amount of risk here because, you know, Saudi Arabia remains an important security partner. If the Houthis fire missiles into the interior of Saudi Arabia, as they have been doing, I think there will be calls for the Biden administration to either reverse this or to take actions to basically step in and act as a security guarantor. If we're not going to enable the Saudis to undertake what the Saudis have portrayed largely as defensive operations, then we're going to have to do it ourselves. So there's an element of risk here.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Saudi Foreign Minister Faisal Ibn Farhan discussed the war in Yemen in a phone call, as well as regional security, counterterrorism, and cooperation to deter and defend against attacks on the kingdom. What's your take on that?
Well, I think it's something that you have to do, you know, in order to distinguish the cessation of support for offensive operations in Yemen, even if that's only a symbolic cessation at this point, from what is a long-standing American commitment to the territorial integrity and security of Saudi Arabia. So I think that the purpose of the Blinken-Faisal phone call was to underscore the fact that we have a difference on this one issue. It does not mean that we are just surrendering you to the tender mercies of Iran, that we continue to value our security partnership. And indeed, we will probably broaden it in areas which are shared. But the ongoing war in Yemen has become counterproductive from a Saudi point of view as well as an American point of view. And so that cessation of support shouldn't be taken as renunciation of bilateral ties.
That was the Near East Asia Center for Strategic Studies, David DeRoche, speaking to my colleague, Mohammed El-Shanawi. February is Black History Month in the United States. It's a time to note and appreciate the enormous contributions that African Americans have made to American and world culture. Now, speaking of enormous, rapindustry.com estimates that rap and hip-hop have brought in over $21 billion in streaming, concerts, and sales revenue in 2019, and that number continues to grow. However, sometimes lost in hip-hop's glitz and glamour are the roots of its global phenomenon in the streets of the Bronx, New York, in the late 1960s and 70s. Now, to find out more about this popular music genre and its important place in Black history, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Grandmaster Caz, one of hip-hop's legendary pioneers. Grandmaster Caz began their conversation by listing the elements that go into the world's most popular popular music.
Well, hip-hop is a culture based on a music element, an art element, a dance element, and a spoken word element. Those elements together make up the culture of hip-hop.
The spoken word element goes back at least to slavery times.
Definitely, and that eventually evolved into rhyme, verse, and eventually rap. I've been quoted as saying hip-hop didn't invent anything, hip-hop reinvented everything. In its inception, it was a purely cultural thing that evolved into a multi-billion dollar industry.
What's the difference between hip-hop and rap?
Well, rap is one of the elements that make up the culture of hip-hop, but rap is the only one that's been monetized to a degree where it's created an industry unto itself that eventually enabled people to become financially independent.
How did you get involved in this new medium as a very, very young man?
I followed the example of elders in my neighborhood, in my community, and once I caught the bug and I was old enough to be able to participate, you know, I started my journey. I became a DJ. I started out dancing and then eventually picking up the microphone, and there you go.
Will you share with us a little piece of one of your creations from those early days?
Well, one of my earliest lyrics that you may recognize goes, I'm the C-A-S-N, the O-V-A-N, the rest is F-L-Y. You see, I go by the code of the doctor of the mix. These reasons, I'll tell you why. You see, I'm 6'1", and I'm tons of fun, and I dress to a T. You see, I got more clothes than Muhammad Ali, but I dress so viciously. That's just a clip. And if you know hip-hop, you'll recognize it from the song Rapper's Delight by the Sugar Hill Gang.
Actually, there's a lot of lore out there in the hip-hop community about how you didn't get the credit or the money you deserve for that big hit song by Sugar Hill Gang. That's a fairly common story about the music industry, you know, back in the day.
Yes, indeed. Especially African-Americans. We've been duped and tricked. But hip-hop is one of those things that have helped to alleviate that. Because of the internet and social media, we can go out independently and manage our own business outside of a record company or having to be signed to a particular entity.
But back to those early days, you and the other young pioneers were doing something important together.
Yes, yes, it definitely was. And I mean, it's easy to say that afterwards. Once it gets away from you, a lot of people try to paint a perfect picture of it. But hip hop is very competitive throughout. And as more people start getting involved, people are more concerned with, you know, holding their status or their stature. And once the recording industry came into play, it was life or death almost to maintain the status quo, to stay relevant or things like that. That kind of, it helped the game, but then again, it kind of took the soul away from it, the purity of just doing it.
But it seems like there are good feelings today between the early rappers. You often appear together and really seem to enjoy each other.
I think the fact that we were at its inception, that bonds us. We created history unknowingly, but we created history. And years from now, depending on how well we're documented, we will always be at the forefront of this culture.
And of course, hip-hop has become an expressive medium around the world for youth. It's at the core of many political and even revolutionary movements for social and political justice. Why does hip-hop continue to be so attractive to the world's young people?
They relate to it because hip-hop comes from the hood. It comes from struggle. It comes from taking nothing and making it something. And that's relative to the majority of our planet. Everybody's not rich. Everybody's not empowered. Everybody's not, you know, free.
But you gotta admit that to many outsiders, there's a lot about rap and hip-hop culture that seems very far from positive. One thinks of the rise of gangster rap, for example.
That was a regression in the culture of hip-hop. When hip-hop was socially conscious, when hip-hop had the youth put down the gold chains and put on red, black, and green medallions, they become conscious and aware of the struggle. A plan was implemented to change hip-hop and make it detrimental. And that's where gangster rap and the glorification of guns and drugs came into play. Luckily, there's always going to be some diehards, and hip-hop is always going to have an underground and an element that's purer to the culture than to the commerce.
That's the legendary Grandmaster Caz speaking to VOA's Adam Phillips. And you've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well and be safe.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Resetting the United States on a sustainable path toward mitigating climate change is at the top of President Joe Biden's agenda. On day one, the new president took immediate action to rejoin the Paris Agreement. Then, within days of being sworn into office, the president signed a flurry of executive actions aimed at tackling the climate crisis at home and abroad, making broad changes to government policy. But climate change is a global challenge that cannot be managed without decisive international cooperation. John Kerry is President Biden's special presidential envoy for climate at the January 27th virtual meeting of the Davos World Economic Forum.
Domestic action cannot possibly be enough if we don't together forge an international strategy to galvanize the world, to drive greater ambition from every country, every sector, and ensure that the clean energy future we need is global in scope and scale.
2020 stands as the warmest year on record, according to the U.S. National Aeronautics and Space Administration, or NASA. In order to keep global temperatures from rising more than 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, which many experts consider necessary to stave off catastrophic harm, we need to cut global emissions in half by 2030, said Secretary Kerry.
It means we have to phase out coal five times faster than we have been. It means we have to increase tree cover five times faster. It means we have to ramp up renewable energy six times faster. It means we have to transition to electric vehicles at a rate 22 times faster.
All of that is achievable if we plan, if we invest, and if we tap the forces of the marketplace, said Secretary Kerry.
We have to get away from this argument that deniers and procrastinators have made that this is a choice between a quality of life or taking care of this challenge. Success means tapping into the best of global ingenuity, creativity, and diplomacy, from brain power to alternative energy power, using every tool we have to get where we need to go. A zero emissions future offers remarkable opportunity for business, for clean green jobs, for economic growth.
It's fair to say that we don't have a single moment to waste, says Secretary Kerry. The whole world has come to this table to solve the problem.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.